NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
Here we are again. Greg is tied up today, so it's you and I. And I wanted to do just a quick little briefing on the helicopter accident. As typically we hear on the news channels, a lot of speculation. And I'll tell you, they must have an awful crystal ball, because I look at it and I would never say some of the things that I've heard on the 24-hour news channels the last few days. So why don't you give us a little quick intro into it with what the event was, and then we'll talk about what we can see that has happened.
This was an accident involving a Bell 206, a long-ranger helicopter in New York City. This was on the 10th of April, 2025. This was a sightseeing flight with a family of five and a single pilot. It was a routine flight. It took off from near the southern tip of Manhattan, went up the Hudson River toward the north along the New York side, turned around just past the George Washington Bridge. As those of you watching the video can see a graphic of the flight path of this helicopter. And as it was approaching lower Manhattan from a normal flight, it was in a slight descent, nothing out of the ordinary, no emergency calls. The helicopter apparently had a loss of control. It made a sudden turn from flying straight to basically being at right angles to its path of flight. And very soon thereafter, pieces of the helicopter started falling off, including the tail boom and the main rotor. And the fuselage, what was left of it, crashed into the Hudson River. And unfortunately, all those on board were killed. This was something that was caught on at least two video cameras, and we have pieces of those showing you. One of them shows the aircraft very briefly in what seems to be a level or near-level flight, nothing out of the ordinary, and very, very quickly, it turns sideways and starts to descend, and pieces start falling off. The main fuselage, with everyone on board, fell in one location. Various other pieces were elsewhere in the Hudson, and at one point, you could see what appears to be the main rotor of this two-bladed helicopter fluttering down. And from our view of the video, what we could tell from the video, it looked as though both of these blades were intact. That is, they were both roughly the same length, didn't see any gouges in them. But again, this was a low-grade video shot from a distance. There will be an ongoing investigation. I think as we speak now, we're speaking about 3 days after the event, they're still looking for pieces of the helicopter at the bottom of the Hudson. It's a national news story here in the United States and plenty of coverage around the world. And begs the question, how could this happen? And John, you, during your time on the board, had a number of experiences investigating air tour helicopters, which fly under a different set of regulations than your typical passenger aircraft. So take us through that. How is it different from your regional jet or your airliner flights you might take?
Right. So basically, the regulations that control flight in the U.S. are in three groups. Now, I'm going to just make it broad-brushed. I'm not going to go into the little nuances on these. But there's three different groups. Part 91 deals with general aviation aircraft, typically the small Cessnas and small airplanes. They can be bigger, but typically it's the small ones. And it's usually an owner-operated airplane. The restrictions on the pilot, the restrictions on the airplane are much, much lower. In fact, the airplane only requires an inspection once a year, or every 100 hours, whichever comes first. The next level up is when you start hauling passengers for money. And that is 135 operation. There's more restrictions on 135. Pilots need more training. The vehicle needs more inspection, more maintenance. All right, so there's more focus on both the pilots and the vehicle. And then the 121 is the American and Delta, and they have the highest restriction on their pilots, the highest training requirements, duty day. They can only fly for 8 hours a day with a little fudge in there for certain things. And the airplane meets a much, much higher standard for maintenance and inspections. So those are the basic three blocks that you would put the different operations in, except for helicopter tour or tours in general. In this type of operation, they can operate under 91. Now, the carrier itself had a 135 certificate. So now it gets to be a real hybrid, because you can't keep hopping from 135 to 91. So the pilot training would be higher, and some of the requirements for maintenance would be higher.
We're at the very earliest stages of the investigation. The NTSB is, I believe, still on the on-scene version of the investigation.
Yes, we are.
It may be weeks before there's, for example, the completion of the search for parts on the bottom of the Hudson River and a preliminary report being released. So some of the basic information that you talked about, how was the aircraft maintained? Was it maintained constantly on a Part 135 basis or not? The pilot was someone who had nearly 800 hours of time, but there is no information, at least now, as to how much of that time was in this particular model of helicopter. And the tour itself, although the route is known because that sort of information is already public, what isn't known, at least at this point, was this a standard route of this particular tour company? Was there anything special about this flight versus the others that are typically taken?
Well, when I looked at the routing of this airplane before the accident, it's a typical sightseeing trip up to South George Washington Bridge and then back down the river. This pilot took the extra step of actually calling the control tower for that airspace to make sure they were aware that he was there and keep him advised of any traffic in it. And he didn't have to do that, but he did it. And all the way up to just before the accident, given the data that we have available, it was absolutely uneventful sequence. And then something happened. Very catastrophic. And I'm looking at those pictures. I'm looking at it. And just like you said, Todd, when something happened and the helicopter started to react violently, you can see some pieces coming off the helicopter before the rotor seems to appear. Now, the pictures aren't the best in the world, admittedly. So this is a little bit of speculation, but it's clear that something came apart. That's obvious. Was the rotor, the blades, and the attaching hardware, which we routinely call the rotor in the middle, was that all one piece that came off? It looks like it. That's very unusual. If you hit a bird, flock of birds, two things can happen. Typically, you might break a blade, and those blades are pretty strong. But you could break a piece of the blade off, and that would give you a severe vibration, which would shake the airplane to death. The other thing that happens when you get bird strikes, sometimes you drive the bird down into the into the cockpit of the helicopter, and actually sometimes have actually incapacitated the pilot in some form and caused a crash. Doesn't look like that happened. And again, from the pictures, it doesn't look like that happened. So we're all speculating. Everybody's speculating on that.
One of the few pieces of hard evidence that we have here are some of the pictures that were released by the NTSB that showed the fuselage of the helicopter as they were recovering it. And it looks to me, I'm no expert on it, but it looks to me like there was very severe crash forces when this helicopter hit the water. And that might make it difficult to find some of the articles inside of the helicopter. Specifically, this helicopter was not required to have a cockpit voice recorder or flight data recorder. So far, the only flight data we have is from publicly available data from places like Flight Radar 24. There might be some information in the individual avionics units that has additional information that, yes, is yet to be seen. There might actually be video from one or more of the occupants from their personal electronic devices. There's no word on whether that has been recovered or not. And if it is recovered, then they'll mention it in the report and might even mention it in the public docket that comes out later. There's no guarantee that those will be released for any number of reasons. So the amount of information the NTSB has at this point is limited. It may get better, but it's unlikely.
Well, at this point in time, given what we've known so far, I'll guarantee you the NTSB is already having had people down to Louisiana to look at the maintenance records, the past maintenance records, and to wherever this company that leased this helicopter was doing their maintenance. So they're going to dig into all those records because it's clear that maintenance could be involved in this. The process of maintenance. What was done to this helicopter is going to go under the microscope. And the pieces that scattered, they are going to make a maximum effort to try to find them. And in that river, they're going to have a challenge. There's a lot of debris in that river. The bigger pieces they may be able to find. The whole rotor, the blades in the rotor, they may be able to find those. But some of those other pieces, they're going to have a heck of a time trying to find them.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with New York City, Manhattan Island, as you can see from the picture, for those of you watching the video version of this, runs roughly north and south, and the Hudson River is flowing downwards toward the bay. And we have the bay, and we have the Atlantic Ocean there. So if you have a light piece that's floating on top of the water, who knows where it could end up? And it might be indistinguishable from a lot of other debris that is on the shoreline of New Jersey and New York. For the heavier pieces, of course, they might sink to the bottom of the river, but I've never been to the bottom of the Hudson River. I don't know what kind of visibility or what kind of mud or debris or plants are down there, but it's going to be a challenge to do that. Plus, the river is flowing, so there's that as well. And the longer it takes, the less likely they'll find something.
If the tide was going out, that river flows pretty quickly. If tide is coming in, it's not so quick. And because there's a tug of war between the tide trying to come in and the river trying to go out. So it's interesting. But the water's deep there, so, maybe 60 feet in places in that area. And also, based upon how long it took them to find the engine from the airplane that went into the US Air airplane that went into the Hudson, they lost an engine when the airplane struck the water. It took them a couple of days to find that, and that's a big chunk of metal. So the blades on the helicopter are mostly composite, which is lightweight material. If the river was running at that time down with an outgoing tide, it could carry quite a way. So they're going to have a challenge finding a lot of those pieces. But make no mistake, they were going to make an effort to find them. The fo NTSB focus right now is going to be maintenance records and recovering as much of that vehicle as they can. And that recovery will probably continue for several weeks, if not more.
And on that subject, let me just send a message out there to anyone in the New York area, New York, New Jersey area, who might be, I'm not sure how to phrase this, who might be looking for souvenirs. If you do find something that you suspect to be a piece of this aircraft, or if you have any kind of video or audio or other evidence that could be useful for this, it is the best thing, I think, for you to turn that over to the authorities as soon as possible. Yes, those of you who have video might want to sell it someplace. That's your right. But at the same time, turning that over to the NTSB as soon as possible will help in this investigation. Now, John, let me take you back a couple of minutes. You mentioned the operators in Louisiana. Now, the average person might think this is a New York City flight. This helicopter is operating in New York City. Why would it have a operator in another state? And is it going to be a sort of a difficult thing to keep track of the helicopter maintenance if your operator is in one part of the country and your airplane, or in this case, a helicopter, regularly flies in another part of the country?
Well, the helicopter was leased from that company in Louisiana. Not uncommon. These companies have helicopters to do certain jobs. Maybe the job is no longer their job to do. Maybe they're flying out to the oil rigs in the Gulf, and now they have a rig shut down, because they do shut them down once in a while. Right, so there's lots of reason why they no longer need that helicopter. And they lease it to another company to use it. The maintenance records, the logbook essentially, will leave with the airplane. But the owner of that helicopter will also keep a set of records and will also keep tabs on the helicopter. So this, you don't want to lose anything in the split between the owner of the helicopter and the operator of the helicopter. The operator has a responsibility to maintain the maintenance records on the vehicle. Right, so the New York operation needed to maintain all the records, perform all the inspections required. And the owner of it needs to monitor that operation.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
Well, JT, I understand that you have years and years of experience in insurance business, but you're here for 2 years, is that correct?
A little over 2 years, yes.
Why did you come here?
For a change of scenery, let's say. Been in the business and industry for a long time, P&C side, underwriting claims, everything, marketing. I've worked with some of these people in the past, prior carrier, and thought it would be interesting, educational, something new I wanted to try and learn about. So I took the leap, and I love it. Absolutely love it.
So what makes you an expert in aviation, since you're talking with pilots and trying to determine whether or not Avemco is going to insure them?
The pilots themselves have been my best teachers. Speaking with the pilots over the last 2+ years has been fantastic. It's been such a great learning experience, learning curve for me. I've learned so much. We've done ground school. We've had CFI come in, give us hours of ground school, worked in the simulator, going to the flight shows, different things, Sun and Fun, Oshkosh, do the NAFI summit, things like that, talking to the folks down there. It's been absolutely great learning experience and a pleasure for me. I enjoy it immensely.
So what's been really the most challenging element of this business now that you're on the aviation side?
Learning the ins and outs of the planes. The underwriting side, I know how to underwrite. I get the information I need from people, but learning about the types of planes that we're insuring, that was the biggest learning curve. And I think I've got a pretty good grasp on that now from talking to the pilots and in-house education. So that was the biggest challenge, going from, say, commercial buildings to Cessnas or Pipers or something like that.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
What kind of physical records are typically kept on the aircraft? And how difficult is the investigation going to be if those physical records are not recovered?
Sometimes you lose a few days worth of records. That's true. Right? But most of the time, the logbook has a duplicate page. When you fill it out, when the release is signed, they pull one page. Usually it's the original, and the carbon copy stays in the airplane so that people can review in different locations, can review the work that was done on the vehicle. All right, so those records should be available wherever that helicopter was based. Sometimes if an inspection is not required for, say, every 25 hours of flying, which is not uncommon for airliners, you could be in multiple locations during that 25 hours, and there may be something put into the logbook, pilot discrepancies, and get addressed that you might lose. But you go back and talk to everybody who touched the vehicle. That's another thing that the NTSB is doing right now, is they're doing interviews of anybody that had anything to do with this operation. Other pilots, dispatch, the fuelers, he called for fuel. He had to have been fueled earlier in the day. So they'll be talking to all of those people to see if there was anything that they may have seen or heard. You know, what, maybe the helicopter was making unusual noises when it took off, or even while it was flying, that they said, you know, it didn't sound right to them. And they, so the NTSB looking at all of that, all of that.
So let me mention a couple of things here. You mentioned he called for fuel, and in my review of some of the things that are online, there are some content creators out there who are making a big deal. Oh, my, he's calling for fuel. Was there something wrong with the helicopter? My first thought was, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But even if a helicopter runs out of fuel, it's not like they fall like a rock out of the sky.
No, that I don't believe that's a concern here. He's just telling them on the ground that bring the fuel out. Usually in a helicopter operation, it's not a fuel truck on this river operations, because they're out on a pier into the harbor where they usually land. All right, so it's a bowser. All right, so it's a small fuel tank on rubber-tired four wheels, which they will drag out to put fuel in the helicopter. You know, a full tank on a helicopter might be 90 gallons. So it's not a lot of fuel we're talking about. I don't believe, based upon what we know so far, that that is an issue. The issue seems to be focused more on the condition of the helicopter at the time of this flight, right? So when I first saw it come out, there's a couple of pretty substantial bearings in the gearbox that holds that whole assembly, that rotating assembly, onto the helicopter, onto the body of the helicopter. All right, so you got this mass spinning around at a pretty good clip because the engine is putting power through the gearbox and up the tower shaft. All right, so it's spinning all of it. There are a couple of bearings in there that are designed to hold that together. So a gearbox failure, mechanical failure where the thing actually came apart. When they come apart, it's like a little explosion. It could be an oil system failure where the bearings were not getting oil and they disintegrated and came out. So that's another area that the NTSB was looking at. Hopefully the engine and those pieces are still in the helicopter, and that'll tell them a lot. I couldn't tell from the pictures that were available if it was obvious that it was there or not, because most of the fiberglass at that area of sheet metal or fiberglass in the area were torn away, but it still wasn't clear to me whether or not the gearbox was intact. And in fact, it was just a boom leaving off the gearbox field totally. But those clues will be looked at very carefully.
During the press conference with the chair of the NTSB, she was commenting about the split between Part 91 and Part 135 and how these kinds of flights are Part 91. This is not a new issue. This was a struggle. You struggled with this during your time on the board as well. Why has there been no change?
It predates my time on the board. In fact, I did and visited several air tour operators around the country, including Hawaii. There was a few accidents in Hawaii with air tours, and I actually was over to watch their operations and see what they're doing. the helicopter industry, the people who operate helicopters, not the manufacturers, but the people who operate helicopters, many of them go to great lengths to avoid having any problems with their operation. But, you know, accidents do happen and helicopters are risky. So, you know, you hate to say it, but it is possible that the accidents on helicopters may happen more frequently than we like. But there are operators that are trying their best not to have that. And in fact, I just recently visited one in Louisiana. As a matter of fact, I was down there for 4 days and toured their operation and talked to their people. And they go to that particular operator. It's not related in any way to this one that owned this airplane. But that's the operator that I visited goes to great lengths to take care of their vehicles. Great lengths. I was really pleased to see how much care that they gave to their fleet of helicopters. And they actually have some airplanes as well. So there's a lot of people putting a lot of effort in to try to make sure that these kinds of problems don't happen. I don't want to speculate on this one, but it does look like at this point in time that there is a problem with the mechanical systems on the airplane. It could have been a pre-existing crack. It could have been a failure of materials, which is seems to be unlikely given the age of this vehicle. You know, material failures that are built into something usually when it's manufactured, usually manifest themselves in a relatively short period of time. 2006 to now is not a short period of time. So I think the pieces on this vehicle have stood the test of time.
Before we go to our last words here, what advice could you give to anyone who's considering taking themselves or their friends or family or paying for someone else to go on an air tour in a helicopter or an aircraft, not just in New York City, but anywhere around the country and around the world?
I'll tell you what, I've done this. I've been on a number of helicopters, including Grand Canyon tours and Hawaii tours. And I pay a lot of attention to the helicopter before I get on it. Usually they're coming and going. I look at their condition. I look at their pilots. Are they steady pilots, or they look like they're hot rodding around? You want a nice, slow and steady pilot. From the pictures of this helicopter previous to this flight, it looked like it was in pretty good condition. You know, a good paint job doesn't mean much, but it looks like the care for the helicopter, it looked clean. The pictures of the young lady sitting in the front seat, as I was looking at the helicopter, looked pretty good. So I'm not so sure that negligence on the part of the operator is going to be so obvious. It may be more deeply embedded into the operation. Hopefully that they had some more modern instruments in it than the 2006 versions that were built into this airplane, because the more modern instruments, many of them use non-volatile memory in their chips that are in them, and that memory will tell us what the condition of those parts were prior to the crash. You mentioned that there's no requirement for a voice recorder or a flight data recorder. We tried pretty hard. We pushed on the FAA when I was there pretty hard to do something about that, and we failed. Back then, and you know, I was there for prior to 2004. I left in the middle of 2004. And we were trying for years and years before that. The FAA, for whatever reason, just wouldn't go there. So the pressure, political pressure or whatever, on the FAA must have been pretty severe to keep them from going in anywhere near that subject. So, it'll come to the surface again on this accident. And let's see what happens with that.
You know, my second to last word is related to the kind of mentality you have when you take a flight like this. You know, you might plan on a trip to New York or wherever. You might plan a long time in advance, but you don't usually plan to do something on the spur of the moment. You go there, you see the helicopters flying, or you go to a theme park and you see a roller coaster, say, boy, that'll be fun. And then you go up to it and you say to yourself, okay, now that I'm here, I have second thoughts, but gee, I paid all this money. Could be $2, could be $2,000. My advice is very simple. If it's an emotional reaction why you decided to do that certain thing, your emotions change before you step on board, walk away, even if you lose your money. Because check it out, this was fun money. It's not like you were paying the rent money to go fly in a helicopter. If you get there and you feel like I'm better off on the ground watching my friends fly, do that. You'll still have a story to tell, just not one from an aerial perspective.
Yeah, this is going to be a tough accident to solve. And it's also very difficult. The families in Spain, so it's going to be very difficult on them. You know, they recovered everybody. It's just terrible. It's a tragedy. And they're all tragedies, but boy, it's, if it proves to be maintenance and it was something that was avoidable, it's just, you know, I did those. I'm a maintainer myself, right? And when I went to accidents that involved maintenance, and ultimately the fault was maintenance, those were painful to me, right? Because, you know, my heart and soul was in maintaining airplanes my whole life. I did whatever I could to make sure that the airplane was operated as safely as it could be from a maintenance point of view. And when you see them fail, you know then that there's going to be a couple, one or two or maybe more victims that were not on the airplane. Because in the accidents that I've seen where maintenance was involved, right, mechanics, they take it tough. They take it very, very personal, and most of them needed a lot of assistance from professionals to get through it. We've had some years ago that I was around the edges for, that they went off and did something stupid to themselves because of the guilt of what happened. So I'm hoping that that's not the case. I'd rather a pure mechanical failure than something that some mechanic had done wrong. But it's sure looking right now, and this is speculation, but it's sure looking right now like it was a maintenance problem that may actually be poor maintenance, poorly applied or poorly programmed in. So we'll have to wait and see. But our hearts go out to the families of those five people. Actually, it's all six pilot as well. Goes out to them. And I'll leave that as my last word.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Not all aircraft insurance policies and premiums are the same. As the only direct writer in the market, Avemco never uses third-party insurance agents and instead connects you directly with an aviation underwriter in their Frederick, Maryland office, ready to solve problems and to approve coverage based on what you fly and how you fly it. Avemco provides lightning-fast quotes, competitive rates, and personalized policies that are easy to read and tailored to you. Call 888-879-0389 for your free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them you're a listener of our podcast and save 5%.
Premium credits are subject to underwriting guidelines, including Avemco-recognized training and memberships.